A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been deep in his Unify dashboard, and the thing that caught him wasn't the throughput numbers or the pretty topology map. It was the warnings. Set your country code wrong, and the interface basically flashes a legal disclaimer at you. His question, stripped down, is, whose air are we actually breathing when we turn on Wi-Fi? And what happens if we breathe wrong?
The country code dropdown is secretly a map of global spectrum politics. Every entry in that list represents a negotiation, sometimes decades old, between a national regulator and the ITU, between military users and civilian allocations, between weather satellites and Netflix, and the fact that you can't just pick Japan to unlock Channel 14,
which everyone has tried.
That's not a software limitation, that's a legal boundary rendered as a UI element. Think of it like a border checkpoint in a drop-down menu. You click United States and you're agreeing to the FCC's terms of service for the air itself.
So let's start with the map. What does the regulatory landscape actually look like, country by country, and where does Israel sit on it?
Israel's regulator is the Ministry of Communications, the MOCI, and they've historically aligned closely with the European ETSI framework, but with their own local decisions layered on top. It's not a straight copy-paste. They look at what Europe does, then they ask, what's different about our geography, our military posture, our neighbors? And the answers produce these little deviations. On the 2.4 GHz band, Israel permits channels 1 through 13, same as Europe. Indoor, max EIRP is 20 dBm, that's 100 milliwatts. Outdoor point-to-point with directional antennas, you can push to 30 dBm, 1 watt.
And for 5 GHz?
Channels 36 through 64 and 100 through 140 are permitted. But here's the key, DFS is mandatory on all 5 GHz bands in Israel, every single one. Europe only requires DFS above channel 48. The lower channels, 36 to 48, are DFS exempt under ETSI. Israel doesn't give you that carve out.
Which means every 5 GHz channel in Israel is subject to the 60-second listening period and the possibility of sudden eviction.
And the 6 GHz band. As of mid-2026, Israel hasn't opened it yet. They're still evaluating. The U.S. opened the full 1.2 GHz in 2023 with AFC for outdoor use. Europe opened about 500 MHz in 2024, low power indoor only. Israel is watching and waiting, which is honestly very on-brand for the MOCI.
What does watching and waiting actually look like in practice? Are they running test deployments? Are they just thinking?
They're doing what regulators do, stakeholder consultations. They're asking the mobile operators, the military, the fixed satellite people, the broadcasters, who's already using 6 GHz in Israel, and would Wi-Fi cause problems for you? That process takes years because every stakeholder has an incentive to exaggerate their need and minimize the other guys. The mobile operators want the spectrum for 5G backhaul. The satellite people want it kept clear for uplinks. The Wi-Fi industry wants it open for unlicensed use. The MOCI has to sort through all of that and decide who gets what, or who gets nothing.
So if I'm a Unify user in Tel Aviv versus one in New York versus one in Berlin, what's actually different in my channel picker?
The American user gets channels 1 through 11 on 2.4 GHz, no 12, no 13. On 5 GHz, they get the full UNI spread, UNI 1 through UNI 1. 3 with DFS only required on UNI 2 and UNI 2 extended. They also get 6 GHz with AFC. The European user gets channels 1 through 13 on 2.4, DFS on all 5 GHz channels above 48, and low power 6 GHz indoor. The Israeli user gets channels 1 through 13, DFS on everything 5 GHz, and no 6 GHz at all. Three different realities, same hardware.
And Japan is the weird one.
Japan is always the weird one in spectrum discussions. They allow channel 14 on 2.4 GHz, which exists literally nowhere else in the world. But it's restricted to 802.11b, 11 megabits per second, OFDM not permitted. It's a museum piece that still shows up in the regulatory tables.
Why does channel 14 even exist? What's the actual story there?
It's a historical accident that became a regulatory artifact. Before Wi-Fi existed, Japan reserved the 2.484 GHz range for ISM, industrial, scientific, and medical use. When 802.11b was being standardized, Japan negotiated to keep Channel 14 as a domestic-only band. The technical reason is that Channel 14 overlaps with the 2.4835 GHz ISM band edge, and Japan's spectrum allocation had a different guard band philosophy than the FCC's. They were willing to let Channel 14 bleed closer to the edge than the US was.
So it's not that Japan's physics are different. It's that their risk tolerance at the band edge was higher.
Right? And that's a theme you see across spectrum regulation. Every country draws the line between acceptable interference and unacceptable interference in a slightly different place. Japan drew it closer to the edge. The FCC drew it further back. Neither is wrong in a physics sense. They're just different judgments about how much bleed is too much.
And the US said no to Channel 13 for similar edge bleed reasons?
Right, but the story is slightly different. The FCC's Part 15 rules for the 2.4 GHz band were written in the 1980s, before Wi-Fi was even a gleam in the IEEE's eye. Channel 13 extends to 2,483.5 MHz, which the FCC had already reserved for non-licensed devices with much stricter out-of-band emission limits. Rather than rewrite the rules to harmonize, the FCC just didn't. Channel 13 sits in a regulatory gap in the US. The radio hardware could do it, but transmitting, there's a Part 15 violation.
So the channel differences aren't about physics. They're about the sedimentary layers of regulatory decisions made before anyone imagined Wi-Fi.
That's the whole story of spectrum allocation, honestly. Every band is haunted by the uses it was originally assigned to. Wi-Fi is almost always a secondary user, a latecomer, squeezed into the gaps between primary services. And that's the perfect setup for the next piece, because those channel differences are the static picture. The dynamic picture, where regulations come alive in real time, is DFS.
Dynamic frequency selection. The thing that makes your access point suddenly decide a channel is toxic and flee.
And it's one of the few places where a civilian user directly experiences spectrum law as a real-time event. Your AP is humming along on channel 100, and then it's not. It's gone to channel 36, and you're left staring at your unified dashboard wondering what just happened. There's no notification that says radar detected. There's just a channel change, and maybe a cryptic log entry. Most people think their Wi-Fi is just being flaky.
So walk me through the mechanics. What's actually happening in that 60-second listening period?
DFS is a listen-before-talk protocol mandated by the ITU and implemented by the FCC, ETSI, and other regulators. When an access point wants to use a DFS channel, it must first perform a channel availability check, 60 seconds of listening, minimum, with no transmission at all. If it detects a radar pulse above the threshold, -62 dBm for the FCC, -64 dBm for ETSI, it must not transmit on that channel, period.
And once it's over to you on a channel and a radar shows up?
It has 10 seconds to vacate, not 10 seconds to wrap up gracefully, 10 seconds to stop transmitting. And then it must avoid that channel for 30 minutes, the non-occupancy period. The AP can't even check if the radar is gone during that window. It just has to stay off.
That's brutal. What kind of radar are we protecting here?
Two main categories. First, weather radars. Specifically, the terminal Doppler weather radar band at 5,600 to 5,650 MHz. These are the radars at airports that detect wind shear and microbursts. If a plane is landing and the radar is trying to spot a downdraft that could slam it into the runway, your access point's OFDM symbols aren't the priority. Second, military radars. They operate across 5,250 to 5,350 MHz and 5,470 to 5,725 MHz. These are shipboard radars, airborne radars, ground-based surveillance systems. And they were there first. The 5 GHz band was originally allocated to these services. Wi-Fi was added later as a secondary user, which means it must not cause interference and must accept interference from primary users.
So DFS is the technical implementation of, you're a guest here, act like it.
That's exactly what it is. And the detection thresholds are intentionally conservative. Negative 62 dBm is a whisper. It's far below what would actually interfere with a radar. The regulators chose that threshold because of false positive. Vacating a channel unnecessarily is annoying but harmless. A false negative, missing a real radar, could kill people.
Which is why users near airports or military bases see more DFS events.
A UniFi user near Ben Gurion Airport might see their AP jump channels every time a plane lands. That's the weather radar at the airport triggering DFS. And the channel availability check is also why DFS channels take so much longer to come online after a power cycle. Your AP is sitting there in silence for 60 seconds, listening, before it dares to transmit. I've had people tell me their access point is broken because it takes a full minute to start broadcasting after a reboot. It's not broken. It's being polite.
Are there differences in how strictly DFS is implemented across jurisdictions?
Significant ones. The FCC requires DFS on UNI-2 and UNI-2 extended. That's 5,250 to 5,350 and 5,470 to 5,725 MHz. UNI-I1 and UNI-3 are DFS exempt in the U.S. ETSI requires DFS on all 5 GHz channels above 48, which is most of them. Japan has the strictest rules, DFS on 5 GHz with additional Type B detection requirements specifically for weather radar, which means Japanese APs need more sophisticated pulse detection algorithms.
And the EU also mandates transmit power control on DFS bands.
Right, TPC. If no other devices are detected nearby, the AP has to reduce its power by up to 6 dB. The logic is, if nobody's around, you don't need to shout. It's another layer of be a good spectrum neighbor that the US doesn't require.
So if the rules are this strict for civilians, what does it look like when there are no rules? That brings us back to Daniel's CTO story, the ex-military guy talking about pushing Wi-Fi over absurd distances. What does that world actually look like?
It's a completely different universe, and it's the perfect lens for understanding what the civilian regulations are actually protecting. Militaries operate in the same spectrum bands, but with fundamentally different rules. They're primary users. They were there first, and civilian Wi-Fi defers to them. So they can use power levels and techniques that would be wildly illegal for you or me.
Give me numbers.
A military radar can transmit at megawatt peak power. Not milliwatts, megawatts. With a directional antenna that has 30 to 40 dB of gain, the effective radiated power is enormous. They also use frequency-hopping spread spectrum that can jump across hundreds of megahertz, which makes them both harder to jam and harder to accidentally interfere with.
And for communications rather than radar, the point-to-point links.
Military point-to-point links in the 5 GHz band can use 10 watts or more, that's 40 dBm, with high-gain dish antennas. Compare that to the civilian limit of 1 watt, 30 dBm for outdoor point-to-point. A 10-watt transmitter with a 30 dB dish gives you an EIRP of 70 dBm, 10 kilowatts effective. That's enough for a link budget that'll carry 50 to 100 kilometers in clear line of sight.
So the CTO's story about miles or dozens of miles, completely plausible.
Entirely. And it's not even exotic hardware. The physics works with off-the-shelf Wi-Fi chipsets if you remove the regulatory limits. The civilian limit of 100 milliwatts on 2.4 gigahertz is what keeps Wi-Fi at room scale. Remove that, add a directional antenna, and suddenly your living room access point could reach the next town.
Let's run the actual link budget on that. What's the theoretical maximum?
Take a 2.4 gigahertz signal, 1 watt transmitter, 30 dBm. Add a 30 dB dish antenna. Your EIRP is 60 dBm, which is 1 kilowatt effective. In free space, the path loss at 1 kilometer is about 100 dB. At 100 kilometers, it's about 140 dB. Your link budget, with a reasonable receiver sensitivity of negative 90 dBm, gives you about 180 dB to work with. That's enough for over 100 kilometers in free space, no problem. Add trees, buildings, weather, it drops, but tens of kilometers is still achievable.
That's with 1 watt at the transmitter. The military is running 10.
10 watts, sometimes more. and they're using techniques like MIMO with spatial multiplexing, adaptive beamforming, and frequency hopping that civilian gear either can't do or can only do in limited ways. Industrial users, utilities, oil and gas, can license spectrum for fixed wireless at 4.9 GHz in the US or 5.4 GHz in Europe, with power levels up to 4 watts EIRP. That's the middle ground between civilian Wi-Fi and military systems.
There's something almost poetic about the fact that the same chipset that's in a UniFi access point, if you just remove the regulatory firmware limits and attached a dish, could talk to someone in the next city.
The hardware is capable of much more than the law allows. And that's not a bug. It's the whole point. The regulations create a commons. Without power limits, your neighbor's 100-kilometer link would drown out your living room. Without DFS, weather radars would be blinded. The restrictions are what make shared spectrum possible at all.
The country code warning on Daniel's UniFi dashboard isn't bureaucratic nannying. It's the visible edge of a system that prevents spectrum anarchy.
Setting it wrong isn't a settings tweak. It's a legal violation. In the U.S., FCC fines for unauthorized transmissions can reach $10,000 per violation. In some countries, it's criminal. The UniFi warning is there because the consequences are real, and because UniFi doesn't want to be the manufacturer that shipped a device that interfered with a weather radar at a major airport.
Has that actually happened? A manufacturer getting in trouble for DFS failures?
Oh, yes. The FCC has issued enforcement actions against multiple manufacturers whose access points failed to detect radar pulses or didn't vacate channels within the 10-second window. In some cases, the gear was using outdated radar signature databases that didn't recognize newer radar types. In others, the detection algorithms were just buggy. The penalties can include fines, mandatory firmware updates, and in extreme cases, revocation of equipment authorization, which means you can't sell the product in the US anymore. That's an existential threat to a hardware company. So when UniFi puts that country code warning in your dashboard, they're not just being cautious. They're protecting their business.
Which brings us to the actionable part. Daniel's in Jerusalem with his UniFi gear. What should he actually do?
First, on 2.4 GHz, stick to channels 1 through 11. Channel 13 is legal in Israel, but it overlaps with the band edge and can cause interoperability problems with devices that follow US channel plans. Channels 1, 6, and 11 are the non-overlapping sweet spot.
And on 5 GHz?
Since DFS is mandatory on all 5 GHz channels in Israel, you can't avoid it by picking a DFS exempt channel the way you can in Europe. But channels 100 through 140 tend to be less congested than 36 through 48, so you'll get better throughput, at the cost of more DFS events, especially if you're near an airport or military installation. If you need reliable 5 GHz for video conferencing or gaming, use the lower channels and accept the congestion. If you need maximum throughput, use the DFS channels but build in redundancy. Have a fallback channel plan.
The country code setting.
Leave it on Israel. Don't be the person who sets it to the US to unlock channels that aren't legal here. The fines are real, the interference risk is real, and honestly, the Israeli channel plan is already pretty generous on 2.4 and gives you full 5 GHz access. There's not much to gain by cheating.
Understanding DFS also explains why your perfect channel setup sometimes falls apart. That channel plan you spent an afternoon tuning. A passing aircraft's weather radar can blow it up in 10 seconds.
That's not a failure of your network design. That's the system working as intended. Your Netflix stream yielded to a weather satellite. That's the invisible architecture of shared spectrum.
Let's pull back to the bigger picture. The 6 GHz band is opening up globally, and it's already fragmenting. The US opened the full 1.2 GHz. Europe opened about 500 MHz. Israel hasn't decided. Are we going to see the same patchwork we got with 5 GHz?
Almost certainly. Every country has different incumbent users in the 6 GHz band, fixed satellite services, microwave links, utilities. The US could clear the full band because their incumbent profile was different. Europe had more fixed links to work around. Israel is probably doing exactly what you'd expect, surveying who's already there before deciding what to open.
Wi-Fi 7 with its 320 MHz channels makes this more urgent.
A 320 MHz channel is enormous. It can't fit in a fragmented band. If 6 GHz opens in a patchwork, 500 MHz here, 700 there, nothing in between. Wi-Fi 7's headline feature becomes unusable in parts of the world. The industry is pushing hard for global harmonization, but spectrum sovereignty is one of the last things nations are willing to cede. Every country wants to control its own air.
The country code dropdown isn't going away. If anything, it's going to get more complicated.
More countries, more bands, more DFS-like mechanisms. The 6 GHz AFC system in the US, automated frequency coordination, is basically DFS on steroids. Your access point has to check with a central database before transmitting to make sure it won't interfere with fixed microwave links. That's the future, not just listening for radars, but actively coordinating with a spectrum database.
On the record, I think Israel opens the lower 500 megahertz of 6 gigahertz by the end of 2027, and it'll be indoor only, low power, with some kind of AFC requirement. The Moki moves slowly, but the pressure from device manufacturers and consumers will be too much to ignore.
I'll go further. By 2028, we'll see at least 3 countries that currently follow the FCC model break away and adopt something closer to the European 6 GHz plan. The fragmentation isn't done, it's accelerating. And we'll see the first major DFS enforcement action against a manufacturer whose gear didn't vacate a channel fast enough. The radar people are watching.
Here's the thing I keep coming back to. We think of Wi-Fi as this ethereal, invisible thing. It just works, or it doesn't. But every packet is a negotiation. Every channel selection is a legal act. The fact that it works at all, across borders, across 100 different regulatory regimes, is kind of miraculous.
It's a stack of compromises that goes all the way down. The IEEE writes the standards. The ITU allocates the bands. National regulators carve them up. Manufacturers implement the restrictions in firmware. And at the bottom, there's a person in Jerusalem staring at a country code dropdown, trying to decide if Channel 13 is worth it.
It's not. But the fact that you have to think about it, that's the whole story.
Next time your access point drops a channel and your Zoom call freezes for 5 seconds, remember, you just watched a negotiation between your video stream and a weather satellite. That's not a bug. That's shared spectrum working.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the airwaves clear.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you've got a weird prompt about the hidden infrastructure of the internet or anything else that keeps you up at night, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon. Try not to trigger any DFS events in the meantime.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.